Thank you. Good afternoon or good morning for those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I will moderate today's seminar. Today's topic is impacts of heavy or oversized truck shipments on the U.S. highway network. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you, everybody know that unfortunately the voiceover IP is not working today. So you will have to call into the phone line, which in order to be hearing this, you will have already called into the phone line to hear the audio. Today we'll have three presenters: Raimundo Rodriguez of the Idaho Transportation Department, Jack Olson of the North Dakota Department of Transportation, and Scott Marion of the Missouri Department of Transportation. Raimundo Rodriguez is the Motor Carrier Services Manager for the Idaho Transportation Department. He is a lifelong Idaho resident. He started with the Idaho Transportation Department in 1987, and he has held various positions in the department, and in 1995 was appointed as the Port of Entry Operations Officer. In 2006, he was appointed to the position of Port of Entry Manager. In January of 2007, he was appointed to Motor Carrier Services Manager. His duties entail managing the programs of commercial vehicle registration and over-legal permitting for the state of Idaho. Jack Olson is the Assistant Director in the Planning Asset Management Division of the North Dakota Department of Transportation. In this capacity, he leads the department's planning, rail, roadway, and traffic data and cartography sections. His responsibilities include long strategic transportation planning, special studies, discretionary grant applications, cross-border planning, freight and mobility planning, policy development, and general division administration. Scott Marion is the Assistant Director of the Motor Carrier Services Division for the Missouri Department of Transportation. He previously coordinated the department's performance measurement and performance management activities. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated to the presenters and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, please type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. The presenters will not be answering your questions during their presentations, but I'll start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. If we run out of time and are unable to address all questions, we'll attempt to get written responses from the presenters. The PowerPoint presentations used today are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next few weeks, along with the recording and a transcript. I'll notify all attendees once these materials are posted online. One final note, Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you're attending with a group of people, have them type your name into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar. I also encourage everybody, whether or not you're applying for the credits, to download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit it to me after you've filled it out. We'll now go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is impacts of heavy or oversized truck shipments on the U.S. highway network. As a reminder, if you have questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box and they'll be addressed during the last half hour of the seminar. Our first presenter today will be Raimundo Rodriguez of the Idaho Transportation Department. So Raimundo, you can go ahead when you're ready.
All right, thank you very much, Jennifer, and good morning and a good afternoon to those folks who are out there. First of all, Idaho Transportation Department is happy to provide information and wants to thank you folks for listening in. I shall start out the presentation with the first slide, which basically shows one of the bigger movements that we have made here in Idaho. This movement was actually done in 2009, and as you can see, it is a rather large one heading down the highway. This movement was 20 feet wide, 17 feet high, 345 feet long, and it weighed approximately 1,300,000 pounds. This was actually in southeast Idaho. We have a manufacturing plant that produces vessels. This actually went into Wyoming. This is one of the bigger moves that we've done, and I thought it was a nice picture to put on the very first line. Okay.
Do you have the arrow at the bottom left corner of the screen?
No, I don't.
Let's see here. Let me try promoting you again.
This move is so big that we cannot actually move the screen.
All right. Are you seeing it now?
No, I am not.
All right. Well, if you want to just go ahead, I'm not sure why, but if you want to go ahead and let me know, I can click to the next slide for you.
There it goes. It seems to pop back in.
All right. Great.
All right. So first of all, just to give you a little bit of a overview on our permit process, basically Idaho Code states that upon application in writing to our board, basically our department, or other proper authorities in charge of highway, we may issue a special permit for the owner either way that is permitted by law. Interesting thing here is that Idaho Transportation Department, of course, has jurisdiction over the interstate and state highways, but as you can see on that on the previous picture, we have some moves that actually need to use city and county highways. We actually put on the permit that the customer must contact that city or county who has jurisdiction over those highways and apply for a permit also. Sometimes that city or county entity doesn't have a permitting process and will basically say, well, if you have a state permit, you're good to go on our roads. But it's really important for the customer to contact them because they are going to be using those highways. And the reason they have to use those is because they have to avoid either a vertical structure or a bridge structure that this load cannot travel under or over. Some more permit information. Idaho Transportation Department, ITD, issues approximately 66 to 68,000 over legal permits on a yearly basis. We have found that the trend has become that there's more and more non-reducible loads being permitted. About 45 to 50% of these permits are issued for non-reducible loads, and those are loads that cannot be reduced down, such as industry hauling transformers, cranes, vessels, modules. So this has become an increasing pattern for us. And out here out west, we tend to have wide open spaces, so they tend to be bigger and bigger each year as we progress. We do have a centralized over legal permit office. And the nice thing about that is that the majority of our permit requests are done via phone call. So they contact our over legal permit office and get that permit over the phone. Staff-wise, we have 5 permit riders that handle this amount of traffic, and we also have a vehicle size and weight specialist that assists them during their peak hours as far as answering phone calls and also making determinations on size and weight issues. It's a lot of permits for the amount of people that we have, and the nice thing is that we do have a program. It is a mainframe program, but we built it in a way that allows them to streamline the process as they issue these permits. We have found that permits are seasonal, and it's probably the same in states around us. When the weather's nice, people want permits to move their oversized loads. That's when the movement is the safest. Clear weather allows them the visibility to be there. So therefore, when the weather's nice, a lot of permits are being issued. One of the things that we have to do is we have to coordinate the issuance of permits with other ITD staff. But what I mean by that is that when permits exceed a certain size, we have to actually contact our district maintenance engineers where the load is requested to move on. And what that is if a load exceeds 16 feet wide or 16 feet high or 120 feet long, we contact those district maintenance engineers who determine logistical requirements in order to ensure the safe movement and convenience to the traveling public. They have a big responsibility because not only do they verify the route that we may have come up with so that this carrier could move through the state, but they also look at construction restrictions or maybe something new that's out there that may restrict the movement of this load. They also are responsible for informing us how many pilot cars they want on the load as it travels on that highway. And also, there may be a need for a traffic control plan. The load that you saw in the very first slide definitely needs a traffic control plan due to its size. And we want to make sure that the traveling public is safe as these loads are moving down the highway. Another thing that we also do is that usually loads of this size tend to have weight involved also. Now our permit folks can actually issue permits for weight, but when they reach a certain weight limitation or a threshold, then we actually have to submit that information to our ITD bridge engineers so that they can run an analysis of that load going over the routes that they're wishing to travel on. And what that implies is that the permit staff actually has to send the vehicle combination information such as the number of tires, the tire sizes, the axle spacings for the whole combination and the weight on those axles, and also the bridge structures that they're going to be crossing. Our bridge section takes a look at that information and actually uses a software to actually run that load over the proposed route and the structures that they're wishing to go over. They in turn make a determination whether that is something that can be done without harming the infrastructure. So there are times that a customer may want to move on a certain highway, but due to the fact that their weight is too heavy or their axle spaces are too short, the bridge engineer actually can deny a permit. They could actually approve it with several conditions, such as they have to lower their speed as they're going over the structure, maybe centerline the bridge, no other vehicles on the bridge as they're making the move, or actually, as I stated before, they can just deny the permit and say, nope, they're not going to go this route. We need to find an alternate route for them. So there is a lot of coordination with other staff when we're issuing these overlegal permits. Movement of commerce is very important to the Idaho Transportation Department. Our mission is basically that we want to promote safety, mobility, and economic opportunity. So we're always committed to having the safest transportation system possible, and in doing so, we provide a mobility-focused transportation system that drives this economic opportunity. We understand that commerce has to move on the highways, but we realize that we have to balance that with ensuring that it's not only efficient, but it's safe to all who are traveling those highways. Idaho Transportation Department supports the Trucking Advisory Council, and basically that is a council comprised of six members from six different areas in Idaho, and each one represents a different industry and has an equal voice in this committee, or in this council, I should say. And what they do is they advise our board on issues and policies concerning freight transportation, safety, and services in Idaho. They actually will discuss laws, rules, and regulations, policies, and procedures that affect their operations within the state of Idaho, and they can make recommendations to our board, and our board then can determine whether it's something they wish to follow through on, or at least explain why it can or cannot be done. And again, the goal there is safety as well as mobility. Community impacts of oversized loads and overweight loads. Recently, I started issuing permits in 1991, and I had never ever heard of anybody contesting the issuance of an overlegal permit. What we had is, back in 2008, we actually had Imperial Oil approach us about a project that they're going to have in Alberta, Canada, called the Kearl Oil Sands Project. And it's a oil sands mine that's located about 70 miles or 43 miles north of Fort McMurray. And what they want to do is they want to harvest that oil from that sand. And so they approached us in 2008 to determine what were the requirements they needed in order to utilize US 12 for the movement of their equipment. And we worked with them to let them know what they needed to do, what weights would be allowed, what sizes they could move across on US 12. And this equipment was rather big. We're talking about stuff that was about 28 feet high and about 28 feet wide and over 200 feet long, not to mention approximately 400,000 pounds traveling on US 12. There was thought that they wanted to go north on US 95, but there were several vertical structures that would not allow them to pass. So we worked with them. We didn't give them pre-approval because they had to meet all our requirements as well as the safety requirements that we instilled on them. In the process of doing so, the attention of these moves were caught by the citizens along that route, and they wanted to voice their concerns of these movements on US 12. In 2010, Imperial Oil conducted three public open houses in 2010. And the mood and the concern of the citizens at those open houses were that they did not want them to move on this highway due to the fact that US 12 is a scenic byway, and an All-American Road, as well as the fact that the locks at Clearwater River are federally protected wild and scenic rivers. One thing that we stress to them at these open houses is that even though it may be a scenic byway and All-American Road, there still is a requirement that we move commerce on there, and we also explain that that was the viable route for these loads to actually go into Montana so they can proceed on into Canada. At times, the meetings were rather heated, and therefore their intentions were one of, we don't want this in our backyard. They were frustrated by the fact that these moves were, they felt had already been pre-approved, when in fact they had not been pre-approved. Here is a picture of what one of these modules would have looked like as it traveled down US 12. It was 24 feet wide, 30 feet high, 220 feet long, and this one was actually about 600,000 pounds. They were rather substantial in size, but after actually reviewing the route and working with the customer, we could accommodate that. Well, they in turn wanted to hold contested case hearings. And actually, two hearings were held in December 2010 and in April 2011. The main concern that the citizens were concerned with was that we did not take into account public safety thoroughly enough. And one thing that we did do is that we actually had Imperial Oil come up with a transportation plan that actually ended up being about 1,700 pages long, that took into account pretty much every scenario where there could be an issue. They had on there that they had actually contracted with our Idaho State Police to provide police escort on these loads. They also had a medical vehicle that was going to accompany these loads in case they came upon a scene or there may have been a citizen traveling on that highway that needed medical help. The transportation plan also stipulated where they would pull to the side of the road or locations where they could pull to the side would allow traffic to move forward around this vehicle. Due to delays, though, Imperial Oil decided to reduce the size and weight of the modules in order to use alternate highways. They actually, if you can imagine, they actually cut these modules in half at a great expense. Actually cut them in half and reduced the height. What that did was it made them about 15 feet high in the air, and also it reduced the weight by 200,000 pounds. And what they did instead is they decided to move these loads up US 95 and I-90 into Montana. Everybody thinks, okay, they figured out a way to do it without going across US 12, everything's fine. Well, then the citizens of US 95 weren't exactly thrilled that these loads were going to move that way, and there were actually protests as these loads were moving that route. If you have time or you're really interested in seeing some of those protests, just go to YouTube and actually click in Moscow, M-O-S-C-O-W, Idaho, and Curl Oil, and you can actually see video footage of protests as these loads were moving up that highway. We actually had six protesters that were arrested at one time because they failed to remove themselves from the road as instructed by police. There was a lot of passion by the folks on these highways as these loads are being moved, because they feel, well, one first thing I think is that they view it as big oil, but the second thing is they feel that these loads are unsafe. What a lot of the citizens didn't know is that we've been moving loads this size on Idaho highways for a very long time. In fact, back in 2009, we moved a load on US 12 that was pretty much the same size as these modules, but we did it so efficiently and we did it at night because that's when traffic was lowest. Nobody knew we had made a move like that on there. So to our credit, we make these moves all the time. We make sure that they're safe and efficient. The general public typically doesn't know that, but these loads seem to incite a very passionate response in the citizens because of the route that was chosen and the fact that they viewed them as, we did not take their safety considerations into account. during the time that the Imperial Oil modules could not move on US 12, we actually did move 4 coke drums to a refinery in Billings, Montana. The move was done by Emirate International. And here is a picture of those coke drums. These were 29 feet wide, 28 feet high, 226 feet long, and approximately 700,000 pounds. Once again, they had to follow all the same criteria that the Imperial Oil proposed moves had to do. They had to have a traffic control plan, stipulating what they would do in any type of emergency. They had certain times of hours that they could travel, which was predominantly at night because traffic on that highway was generally very low. So we made these moves, and everything went fine, had no issues with them, and these were actually done while Imperial Oil was not allowed to move on US 12. So pretty much just to finish the presentation, once again, this was sort of a hot spot. We've never had contested issuance of permits before. Currently right now, Imperial Oil Specialized Equipment, they have no modules that are Idaho Port of Lewiston. They are moving them still across Idaho, but they're coming in from Washington on I-90. And we're issuing 1 to 2 every day of these moves because they're trying to get these modules up there to the Curl Oil Sands project. Imperial Oil has not contacted us saying that they want to transport any large equipment on US 12. And as always, we will always continue to apply the same principles of safety, mobility, and economic opportunities movement of all commerce on Idaho highways. That concludes my presentation, and I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Raimundo. We'll now continue with our next presentation, and then we'll take questions after all three presentations. But if you continue to think of questions for Raimundo, continue typing them in. Our next presentation will be given by Jack Olson of the North Dakota Department of Transportation. So, Jack, you can go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning or good day to all of you, and I hope this presentation is somewhat informative and interesting. Today, my topic is related to the movement of oil-related traffic, and basically the title here is Understanding, Calculating, and Applying the Impact of Oil-Related Traffic. I'm going to cover 4 areas. First of all, I'll give you an overview of the oil industry and what's happened in North Dakota. Talk a little bit about the composition and volume of oil traffic, followed by how we quantified the impacts of oil traffic on both flexible and rigid pavements. And finally, how we use that information here in North Dakota DOT. The first oil well in North Dakota was drilled in 1951 in a portion of the Williston Basin referred to as the Nesson Anticline. And you see that here marked in red. The anticline, if you look at the bottom of the page here, the Williston Basin is like a big dish-shaped geologic formation. In the middle of that dish-shaped formation is an anticline called the Nesson Anticline. That vertical well that was drilled back in 1951 basically came down through the center of that anticline here and hit the top of a pool of oil, and using the technologies of the day, the Bakken, the formation that this oil is in that many of you have heard on, stretches from northeastern Montana here into northwestern North Dakota on up into Saskatchewan, and it is a very low permeability, low porosity shale formation that really wasn't economically producing oil until the hydraulic fracking technology was employed in the last few years. This graph shows the state's oil production since January of 2000. And at the turn of the decade, North Dakota was producing about 90,000 barrels of oil a day. The green star, right, get my pointer here, not going to come with me. There it goes. Oh, I lost it, excuse me.
And you do have to continue holding your mouse button down as you drag it. It should move with it.
It's not going.
All right.
No. Anyway, about the middle of the page there, you'll see a green star, and that's represents January 2005, and that's really when the most recent oil production flurry kind of restarted in North Dakota, if you would. It started taking off at that time, and since then it's been on a continuous increase, except for a little bit of the time frame during the 2008-2009 recession. We just found out yesterday, my presentation had to change a little bit, that yesterday North Dakota found out that it is now the second ranking oil producing state, having passed both Alaska and California just recently. In Alaska, we just found out yesterday, and now we only trail Texas in the production of oil. We're currently producing 575,000 barrels a day, not the 558 on the screen, because that was as of February. And in March, the total oil production was at 16.8 million barrels of oil. The slide here shows the rig count in North Dakota. And if you go back to the early 1980s, 1984, that was when the previous high rig count was experienced in North Dakota. And at that time, there were 142 rigs working in the state. As of yesterday, there were 210 oil rigs drilling in the state. It's anticipated that as many as 250 rigs will be drilling in the state in the near term. Each of these rigs are capable of drilling between 10 and 12 wells per year, and industry experts anticipate that between 32,000 and 40,000 additional wells will be drilled in North Dakota over the next 15 to 20 years. Significantly, the fact is, that these rigs today, these 210 rigs that are operating in the state today, are about 3 to 4 times more efficient than those rigs that operated in the state back in the early 1980s. But to give you some idea how fast oil production has increased in our state, in 2000, North Dakota was producing, as I mentioned, about 90,000 barrels a day. By August 2008, we were up to almost 4,200 wells with 5.5 million barrels of oil in the month, about 178,000 barrels a day. By February of 2012, these numbers had jumped, and we were producing a little over 16 million barrels in that month, about 560,000 barrels a day, and as I mentioned just recently, finding out yesterday that we're up to 575. Give you some idea of a comparison how that relates to some other oil-producing states. North Dakota, which passed California in January, produced in February, 558,000 versus California at 541,000 barrels a day. We were doing that with about 6,700 wells. California was doing that with about 50,000 wells. Next, after we got some idea what was happening with the pace and the volume of oil development in our state, we wanted to get an understanding of the oil industry, the composition and the volume of oil-related traffic during both the drilling and production phases. We also wanted to identify the origins and destinations of oil traffic so that we could get a feel for what highway segments were being influenced by that oil traffic. This picture, for example, is one of an overworked rig or a drilling rig, and we've quickly found out, for example, that the sizes of these rigs were changing and getting larger. In the early 1990s, these rigs weighed about 90,000 pounds. Today, they weigh about 110,000 pounds. This is true for most all the equipment that's used in the oil industry. It's getting larger. There are many different kinds of pieces of equipment that are necessary to bring an oil well into production, and the truckloads that are involved with each of these kinds of the oil production is dependent on whether the well is drilled vertically or horizontally, and we'll discuss that a little later. And it's also dependent on the depth of the well, the moving efficiencies of the companies that are moving the pieces of equipment. So there's a variety of factors that influence these overall figures, but you'll see here that a vertical well takes about 400 truckloads one way, and a horizontal well takes about 1,150 truckloads, or 2,300 truckloads totally inbound, outbound. Several of the loads that are used to drill a well are over oversized or overweight. And here you'll see a list of some of those larger loads, many of them exceeding the legal loads in North Dakota of 105,500 pounds on most of our highways. The largest of these you'll notice is the mud pump, which weighs 164,000 pounds. And there are two of those that move into each of these sites. Of the 100 or so loads that are used to drill, move just the drilling rig portion of the operation when you're bringing a well into production, 40 to 50 of these are oversized or overweight, and 3 out of 4 loads are also oversized. This picture shows a frack site or a well site that's being fracked. And what that's all about, I guess, is that the Bakken oil shale formation, as I mentioned earlier, has a very low permeability and porosity. So in order to get this oil flowing, you need to go in and fracture the formation where the oil-bearing formation. And this fracking process produces minor cracks in the formation, allowing the oil to seep and be collected at the well bore. This slide shows how a horizontal well is drilled over on the left-hand side. I wish I could get that arrow to come down for you. On the left-hand side, here, there we go, you'll see the well bore coming down, and then it'll go out horizontally. And this goes out about 2 miles in length horizontally, and it's down about 10,000 feet. And they make this curve in the well by putting differential pressure on the bore as it's being drilled. So Bakken wells typically are drilled to a depth of around 10,000 feet. And this lateral that goes out to the side here goes out about 2 miles. And along this lateral, you'll see these little fracture lines here. They will, under a great deal of hydraulic pressure, crack the rock, insert a fluid with a proppant or a sand to hold those little fissures open, and they may do that as many as 40 times along this lateral. The fracking process takes about 3 million gallons of water, delivered in trucks like this or other tanker trucks. Takes about 3 million gallons of water, or 446 one-way truckloads per well of water, and about 4 million pounds of sand, or about 96 one-way truckloads per well of sand. This slide shows kind of the distribution of oil wells in the western part of the state with some of our larger cities there for reference. Oil is initially transported by collection pipelines or trucks to rail transload facilities or pipeline locations by truck, almost exclusively by truck, although we are getting more collection pipelines in all the time. The red circles on this map denote wells that are, the oil is transported by trucks. The green ones indicate wells that use collection pipelines to deliver that oil to pipelines or rail transport. About 70% of all the oil is currently being trucked from wells to pipelines transfer locations. And on average, one of these Bakken wells produces about 3 truckloads of oil per day during its first year of production. Salt water is a byproduct of the oil production. This slide shows the location of permitted saltwater disposal sites. Bakken oil wells produce about 1 barrel of salt water for every 3 barrels of oil during that first year of production. Salt water is transported by pipelines in some cases, but most of it is trucked to saltwater disposal sites in vehicles similar to this one here, where you have a truck with a pump behind it. The average Bakken well, again, produces about 1 truckload of salt water per day during its first year of production. This slide also then shows how that saltwater production production of saltwater in relationship to the oil production has increased over time and is a significant factor in figuring the truck impacts on a highway segment. Individual wells are the destination of sand or proppants, which are used to maintain those cracks in the formation so that the oil can seep. And their sand and proppants are used in that fracking process. 3 years ago, Williston, North Dakota, out at the edge of the state here, was the only location receiving sand for the fracking process. Today, fracked sand and proppants are shipped to several locations by rail and then are transloaded to trucks for final delivery to the well sites. The same is true of pipe that's used in the oil drilling phase. Again, it's brought into the state by rail to several different locations and then transported by truck to the drilling sites. In addition to the state's pipeline infrastructure, which is capable of transporting about 553,000 barrels a day, there are 13 rail transload facilities capable of transporting about 720,000 barrels a day. Unfortunately, rail and pipeline transportation capacity are not always necessarily available relative to the location of the oil's production. Again, the typical truck, similar to the one that we use for saltwater, picture here, can transport about 220 barrels a day. This slide of the EOG Resources rail transload facility near Stanley, North Dakota, currently ships 65,000 barrels of oil per day. Every day, 125 truckloads deliver between 20,000 and 25,000 barrels of oil to the facility. Depending on their size, each of the state's rail transload facilities have similar truck-generating impacts on the system. So after we got a feel for what was happening with the oil industry and the composition and the types of trucks that were being used to move all this, we wanted to compute and quantify the oil-related traffic impacts both on our flexible and our rigid pavements. This picture, for example, is in Williston, North Dakota, of many of the different trucks that are used in the oil industry backed up at a stoplight trying to get through the community. So what we did, a couple of people on our staff here, Stuart Milakovic and Terry Whale, they worked on developing this chart that I know it's difficult to read, but if you want a copy of it, we certainly can provide it. On the left-hand side of the chart, it shows all the different types of trucks and movements that are related to the oil industry and the numbers of them and so forth. And then it also looks at the number of axles and the weight in each of those axles, and from that it computes the gross vehicle, or using gross vehicle weights, or converts those gross vehicle weights and axle loadings to equivalent single axle loadings. And for example, the mud pump, that item that weighs 164,000 pounds, when you look at that, here's that number of loads per well, two in, two out, the number of axles on the steering column, and each grouping of axles thereafter, and then looking at that total weight and the displacement of that weight onto the axles, the computation was made that on a flexible pavement, this particular piece of equipment has a 24.7 diesel impact on flexible pavements and 50.6 on rigid pavements for these four movements. Taking that whole chart and looking at it, then when you looked at all of the various pieces of equipment that were along this side, to drill one single well, we were able to compute then the number of flexible easel impacts on a roadway and also the impacts on a flexible roadway. And I know some people were asking the question, like, what's an easel or what does that mean? I guess the best way to explain it is, as I can best explain it anyway, is that the engineers will look at these loadings on an axle, and an easel is the equivalent of about 18,000 pounds weight on a single axle. And as you look forward into the impacts of traffic on a roadway, you're designing the roadway to carry a certain number of trucks and vehicles over time, kind of like putting money into the bank. You put a deposit in there when you build the road, and as each truck or piece of equipment moves across that highway, it's making a withdrawal on the life of that roadway. And so these easels, then, as they accumulate over time, are taking some of that life out of the roadway. We then also wanted to know what the timing of this development of the oil was all about. And as you see here, what we've done is developed a timing from day one, when the permit for a well is applied for, and that can take up to 30 days before that's issued. Then during the drilling phase, we looked at how many loads were made, how long it lasted. Again, during the drilling phase, when the loads were being, the second portion of that, how long it was, how many loads. Then why it was waiting to be fracked. And then during the fracking process itself, how many loads there were. After that was done, then into the production phase over the life of the well. This process of getting that permit, drilling it, and fracking it takes about 6 months. Finally, what we wanted to know about the industry too is, considering there may be hundreds of wells drilled in a relatively small area, we wanted to know if our traffic counts that we had taken in an area had occurred prior to what we call the oil bubble occurring or after it. And knowing when that traffic counts were taken in relation to that oil bubble is critical to determine the magnitude of the oil traffic impacts on any given highway segment. Our first example here shows, this arrow here, this red one, shows that we took the traffic count on what we would call our normal, during a time of normal traffic, normal growth rate on traffic over time, 2-3%, whatever have you, and the oil impacts on an area had not really been experienced yet at that time. As the oil came about, though, we wanted to compute, again, that traffic count was taken here, so we had to account for all the traffic for whatever number of oil wells were in a certain area, and that's represented by this, what we call the bubble here, and so we had to account for all the traffic in that area below the curve and add it to those traffic forecasts for that normal growth rate to say this would be the impact on that road once that oil traffic starts being experienced. Our second example here is using again now this traffic count right here was taken on during what we maybe call our normal traffic period, but it was already elevated because traffic was being associated with the development of oil in that area already, and we were partly into this bubble when the count was taken. So what we had to do in that case was only count the traffic above that new established baseline. So in that case, this oil bubble only included this much area or additional traffic versus the first example, which included all of the traffic below the curve here. Finally, what we wanted to do with all of this then is, you know, apply this information to specific segments to understand where they were in their life and how much life we would have on those highways additionally, or project the life that was there and determine our schedule for reconstruction. So in this particular instance, you'll see what we refer to as an oil production area. It's many, many square miles. Each of these segments here, the red arrows showing here, white areas are areas where there are no oil spacing units defined. And these oil spacing units are areas that a well would have to stay within as the well bore is drilled in that horizontal drilling. The white ones here, no spacing units. These areas now, pink or tan here, for example, are 640-acre areas or 1 mile squares. And finally, many of the spacing units in western North Dakota are in these pink-colored rectangles, which are 1,280-acre spacing units or 2 square miles. So how does that imply, what it works with that, or how does that use? Here we go again, that same well production, oil producing area, and what we've done here is there are 4 state highways showing here, and we wanted to attribute that traffic to each of these various segments of the highway and understand it. This particular map also shows things like the location of saltwater disposal sites, where rigs are currently, where they get water from for the fracking process, etc. So we looked at one of these units, as we mentioned here, was that 4 highway area again, and we divided that geographic area by closest proximity to a state highway, so basically drew an X here. And this spacing does not account for roads, obstacles such as bridges with lower load limits or topography issues, which then these arrows could be, or these areas could be adjusted to account for. But in this particular area, there were 20 spacing units in this northern portion of this area. And in this case, right now, there are already, as the numbers indicate here, 33 existing wells in this area. And according to our oil and gas folks, when this is all developed, there will be on average 3.8 wells per spacing unit. So, looking at the 33 wells that were there existing already, we wanted to find out the additional traffic that would be generated by the number of wells that could be there, another 43 wells, in essence. And we took that figure then, 20 spacing units times the density, figured out how many wells there would probably be there, 33 existing, came up with the 43 additional wells, and we attributed that traffic then to this roadway segment along here. Now, opposite to that would be another area north of this roadway on the opposite side that would also put traffic onto this roadway. And that was then computing that oil bubble that we would give that information to our materials and research division for the development of pavement designs. We also considered factors such as where the location of the water depots were that are necessary for the getting the well for the fracking process, where the pipe comes from, where the sand or frack proppants come from, and where the equipment is located, out of what community is that equipment coming to, as part of the consideration of attributing additional truck traffic or putting that oil bubble onto this roadway to come up with that traffic projection for the additional traffic that would be generated by oil impacts. But with that, I guess if there's any questions, try to answer them at the end of the station here.
Well, thank you, Jack. We'll move on to our final presentation and then start taking questions after that. But again, continue typing any questions in for Jack that you might have. Our final presentation will be given by Scott Marion of the Missouri Department of Transportation. So Scott, you can start when you're ready.
Thank you. After those previous two presentations, which I thought were fascinating, and to a non-engineer as myself, a little complex, but you gentlemen explained them so well. But my topic seems a little lightweight, even though I would say it's an important topic. And it's simply about some common sense things that we've learned in Missouri as it relates to helping motor carriers respond to emergencies and other natural disasters. As Mr. Rodriguez talked about, every state is set up a little differently in the way that they oversee motor carriers, but at least I hope we can generate some introspective questions of ourselves about, are we prepared, and how we can better prepare ourselves. During natural disasters and other emergencies, the most critical thing we can do is to allow others to respond as quickly as possible. And it really doesn't matter, we've discovered, whether the disaster is in our state or another, we have to respond, because they're going to be coming through your state most likely if the disaster's near you. And the other thing we've learned is we have to be available 24/7 during these emergencies. Unfortunately, here in Missouri, we've had too much practice of late responding to natural disasters. We, of course, had the catastrophic tornado in Joplin last year. This year we had another tornado in Branson, and we've had several rounds of flooding. Overall, we think we've done a pretty good job of doing our part to get the lights back on, but we've learned a few things that we think will help us better prepare in the future. One thing I'd like to point out is that the safety regulations to the traveling public, to our infrastructure, that's still out there. The stuff that we do bureaucratically is still there. But in an emergency, common sense needs to play a part. And here in Missouri, our overriding motto has always been to get the lights on. It's not the time to be a strict bureaucrat, so to speak. One of the first things that someone in your state needs to do before an emergency is to identify who's responsible for what. As we said, every state is different. For instance, the hours of service. These are Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration regulations. They're in place to increase the safety on our highways by limiting the hours that a driver can drive. But during an emergency, someone in your state has the authority to suspend these requirements for a limited amount of time. In Missouri, it happens to be our highway patrol. So one of the questions you need to ask yourself is who is responsible for hours of service in emergencies? Another important consideration is the International Registration Plan, or IRP. IRP is the plan that licenses the motor carriers in each individual state that the carrier will drive in. But if the carrier needs to go through your state or come to your state and hasn't already apportioned or licensed for your state, someone in your state has the authority to waive the fees and allow them in your state during emergencies. Another consideration is the IFTA, or International Fuel Tax Agreement. This particular agreement collects the fuel tax for each individual state or jurisdiction. And again, someone in your state, some agency, someone has the authority to waive the fuel tax. The last people or thing you need to identify that who's responsible for is the oversized overweight. Because of our infrastructure and for safety considerations such as vertical clearance, permits still must be issued on oversized overweight loads during emergencies. In Missouri, we have an agent and permit issuances available 24/7, and that's every day, including during emergencies. And during emergencies, we waive the fees to get these OSOW loads through to help get the lights on. We still, however, must comply with the federal requirements to prohibit the reducible loads on our interstates unless there's a federal emergency declaration. An example of this would be a Walmart truck carrying a load of bottled water for disaster relief, and they weigh 90,000 pounds. They can't get an OSOW permit, and actually they'd be operating illegally on the interstate if there wasn't a federal emergency declaration. So the point I was making with that last slide, we just need to identify who's responsible for what. Utility companies is the next thing I'd like to discuss. They obviously play a major role in responding to natural disasters. A couple things that you need to consider with utility companies is hours of service that we discussed earlier. Utility companies are exempt from the hours of service requirements during emergencies based on federal law, but their contractors are not. So the carriers that are hauling electrical poles or cutting down trees, for instance, they have to comply with the hours of service requirements unless those requirements are waived, which is something that you obviously may want to consider during a natural disaster. In our case, the Highway Patrol would waive those. Also on utility companies, the IFTA and IRP that we talked about, they may need those requirements waived because utility companies often have partner utility companies from other states that aren't apportioned in your state, and they may need to get in there to assist, so you may need to waive those fees and let them in. The other neat thing about utility companies is they're very proactive in responding to emergencies. If there's a hurricane or an ice storm that's highly probable and they've been monitoring the forecast, they'll mobilize way before the storm and they'll most likely need your assistance early. So you need to be prepared for that. They know the drill. They probably do it a lot better than we do as far as pre-mobilization and logistics. So they can really be a good partner for you in this. I know that we've implemented several best practices that we've learned from the utility companies on pre-mobilization and logistics as we get ready to fight snowstorms and plow the snow and ice. This kind of goes without saying, but we need to plan ahead. We have a vital role and responsibility in helping individuals who've lost their homes or don't have electricity because of a major ice storm or tornado. Getting food, water, shelter there as quickly as possible is crucial. One thing I've learned about the carriers is they will step up very quickly and help out. Sometimes they're getting paid and many times they're not. But we have to allow them to get the food and water there. So everything we've talked about so far is how will you contact these people 24/7 and do you know who you need to contact? In natural disasters, time is critical, but it's not only important to know exactly who is responsible, but how will you respond? In other words, what is the process? In Missouri, for example, emergency declarations ultimately rest with the governor. However, the authority can and has often been delegated to our Department of Public Safety, and in certain situations, the declarations can be made by MoDOT on a limited time basis. An example of this would be that our motor carrier services within MoDOT may decide to waive the IRP, IFTA, and OSOW permit fees during a disaster. So we contact our highway patrol, who is responsible for all the roadside enforcement in Missouri, so they'll know not to ticket these folks. And then the highway patrol puts out the official announcements and releases to the other jurisdictions. Some more stuff on planning ahead. Each state has emergency plans, emergency preparedness plans, they practice them, but it's important for your agency and my agency to know our role and the role of the other agencies. Examples are what routes have been identified as military and emergency response routes. Where are the staging areas for relief supplies located? Encourage you to participate in emergency simulations. We test our emergency radios monthly here, and we participate in all the statewide emergency planning. Another consideration is we ran into this during last year's heavy snowstorms, which was the first time we had ever completely shut down I-70 from St. Louis to Kansas City. In previous snowstorms, we had shut down little sections, but never the entire corridor. And because we had never done this before, we ended up having trouble finding safe spots for the trucks to get off the road. So working with our local districts and local officials and law enforcement, we kind of scrambled around and we found some distribution centers and abandoned shopping malls, and we found some safe places for the trucks to park. But we learned that we need to have this pre-planned. So since that time, we've secured truck staging areas during disasters, some of them through MOUs with local cities, and sometimes they've actually been contracts, but it's a good idea to know where you're going to move the trucks to during an emergency. The other thing I'd like you to at least consider is not just the statewide emergency plans, but your particular office or where you work. Dust off your contingency plans, or do you have good plans? This kind of caught us by surprise again. It was actually on May 8th, Truman's birthday, which in Missouri is a state holiday. But the Motor Carrier Service Office is, I think, about the only state office that's still open. Well, since it was a state holiday, we use those, since nobody's working most generally, we use that time to do maintenance work on the computers and the system. So they were doing some routine maintenance on the huge backup generator at our IT building. And when they hooked it back up, they shot about 3 times more power right into the servers than they should have. And our phones were down for most of the day, along with our computer system. And when the phones finally came up, we had 200 OSOW carriers that were needing permits to move that day. And unfortunately, we were not able to help them move because we do almost everything electronically. Our TMS maps that show the vertical clearances and the vertical sag clearances and the weight restrictions on bridges, we just could not safely route them, so they had to wait until the next day. But it got us thinking. We have been so reliant on technology, so we dusted off our contingency plans, and one of our plans was if the power ever goes off again or if we lose our maps, one thing we can do is we can actually issue permits in our SIT or system testing environment, and we can simulate the permit and then manually enter them in the next day. Also, we've decided that we should keep copies of the old paper permits and instructions for getting a permit, keep a few copies of those around so we could do them manually if we had to and fax them. Everything from old maps to paper copies of road restrictions, and also having that radio emergency contact with your local districts. In other words, if it's during an emergency, power's down, but you've got to get a utility truck to turn the lights back on, you may have to radio that local district to find out if that bridge is still there, is it still safe. So the moral of this story is it doesn't hurt to sit down and think of every possibility you can think of and how you might address it. Communication. This one also goes without saying, but it's critical to let the carriers and other states and the rest of your state agencies know what you're doing as soon as possible. And in addition to the normal official channels of communication that we have, we found that during times of disaster that some of the social media works very well. We happen to have a listserv for all of our carriers that they respond to well. We have a Motor Carrier Services Facebook page that has been successful beyond our expectations. Twitter, we regularly appear on Sirius Radio and announce changes, restrictions, road closings, and even mobile apps. I do know that during the tornado in Joplin, for a brief time there was basically no what we'll call MoDOT communication. So cell phones and texting actually became invaluable during that time. Along with our emergency radios, employees were bringing in their personal laptops, air cards, and cell phones, and many times that was the only way that we could communicate. One other point on communication I might mention is if you will get with your utility companies prior to emergencies, they will most likely provide you with a list of the contractors, the subcontractors that they will use in emergencies, and that will be handy for you as they call in for permits. You recognize them, and it will stop a lot of the situations where some guy with a chainsaw is looking to make some money after a tornado, and he gets stopped at a weigh scale and wants to get permitted. One other thing we do during emergencies is before, if we have pre-notice, during, we have daily and sometimes several times a day conference calls throughout the department to just make sure we're communicating well. I'm pretty much done. I realize we only have about 15 minutes for questions and we wanted 30, but this was pretty simple stuff here, nothing new. My goal was just to hopefully provide some reminders that we all need to go and ask the right people the questions and see if we're ready, and do everything to get the lights on. And I believe I'm done.